There we go.
With all those preliminaries. Well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate all of you coming out here Wednesday evening, first day of the conference, to come to speak. See how we're doing on Saturday when I come back again to speak and see if you're still here. For those of you who brought your computers, which I'm sure is all of you, well, maybe not. What I've got going for this talk is what we call back channel. And it's up on that screen there. And if you hold on your computer and you go to that website address, you'll see a comment form and you can type in your comment. And if you type in your comment, it will show up on that screen there for 10 seconds. And then it will disappear. And the idea here is that while I'm up here doing my talk thing, all of you can be doing the comment thing. So you can be making comments about my talk or whatever as I'm giving the talk. So I do hope you brought your computers because you'll be able to take part in this. If you didn't bring your computers, bring them on Saturday, because I'll be doing it again. So what I want to talk today about is, the title of the talk is Kaleidoscope of Futures. You can see I'm sort of running with the theme, but I'm sort of reflecting on my experience being here in Southern California, and my experience being here in Southern California perhaps is most of all colored by that, and that's the scene outside my hotel room first thing this morning. And you can see the smoke plumes and that in the air. I've spent the last couple of days exploring Southern California, and I went down to Disneyland. I didn't go actually into Disneyland because it's cost a fortune. It's like, you know, come from Canada, the Canadian dollar is doing great these days, but it's still really expensive. So I didn't do that, but I went through they call it the town center. And then, of course, Southern California, I went to a couple of malls because, I got to go to some malls. On the way back from one of the malls, I stopped in at the Crystal Cathedral. And, you know, it's funny because I'm walking around, I'm getting ready for this conference, I'm looking at the traffic, and I'm going to the malls, having my coffee up. I'm just struck by the unreality of it because, you know, the newspaper this morning said something like, you know, 1,000 homes destroyed. I'm walking down the street, getting ready for the conference, it's like nothing happened. It was this thing that sort of struck me, the dissonance between where my head was at and where reality was at. So I was thinking, as we came to this conference, about the topic of reality. Reality, I think, is something that's changing. So I thought about that. I asked, what is reality? So, of course, the first thing I'm thinking of is kaleidoscope. Is the kaleidoscope real and all that? You know, I come and I do a lot of these talks and a lot of these conferences, and then I get off the stage later on, and there's always some guy in the back of the room, usually with gray hair like mine, who's been doing this since like 1940. He says, well, yeah, the reality is, and then they'll talk about institutional structures, they'll talk about what learners are ready to do. When I try to set something like this, people would say, well, the reality is nobody brings their computers to these talks. I said, well, it's tough. We use some reality as a rhetorical device, as a way of arguing, is, in my mind, it would be as strong to say the enemy of innovation. That's a headline from Business Week, so they have to, you know, make it a bit stronger than they have to. But it certainly is, well, it's like an anchor on innovation. It sort of holds you back. It's like you have to carry this big weight of reality behind you. There's one you put in the books. So I'm thinking about, what is reality? What do we mean when we say something is real? Well, one way of looking at reality is something is real if it's natural. It's a real flower as compared to an artificial flower. The idea of reality being something that happened without our intervention. Of course, that's not always what we mean by reality. And, you know, it's sort of funny, even things that are created by us, like chairs and cameras and tables, and those are real, even though they're artificial. So, real versus fake. We think, well, things that are fake are not real. And I get these images by doing searches on Google for the headlines. So I did a search on Google, real versus fake, and I came up with Stephen Colbert. Which I thought was kind of interesting in itself. Of course, Stephen Colbert is a quote-unquote fake presidential candidate, which is really kind of strange because he's signing the papers, he's running a campaign, he expects to elect a delegate. So in what sense is that fake? And so we have this sort of odd disjunction here even between the real and the fake. Well, real versus virtual. There's a topic that is in discussions recently. If you're wondering, the little logo on her shirt, I don't think it really comes out, is a Coldwell banker. So it's a real fake, or a fake real estate agent. But we have this idea of the real as being the physical as opposed to the non-digital. Oops, somebody's left their reality interjects. That actually was more like the screensaver interjecting. Just remember, like, I don't really see those as I'm talking, but I go read them after. We have this sense of the real as being something that actually exists as compared to the internet. Okay, that was pretty funny. Speaking of illusory, and maybe I'll just go right to the next slide. I couldn't have planned that one better. But I get that, you know, and I bet you, yeah, I mean, you guys are in educational technology, I bet you get that too. There's this idea of reality as being something even that defines what it is to be sane, right? You know, only a sane person would do such and such, or no sane person would try to wire the university campus. No sane person would think you can teach courses online because you have to have real interaction. And, you know, there's this whole idea of reality intervenes. I did a talk once, and it was in Australia, and they were going online learning from virtual to reality. And the idea of that talk was, of course, that this pipe dream that was online learning was going to become reality. But of course, everybody thinks, you know, online learning, that's not real learning. It's not really fake learning. It's certainly not physical learning. It's kind of like virtual learning. And the point of the talk was that the online learning actually makes the learning more real over time. It makes it more real because it gets us out of this non-real classroom. This artifice, this artificial thing that we create where we go and teach people in very structured, artificial ways. Online learning is able to take us out of that artifice, out of that invention, out of that fiction, and put learning into the community. And that has always struck me as being the thing about online learning, the real power behind online learning. So, what are these realities? The thing with online learning, the thing with internet technologies in general, is that it's creating a shift not simply in learning, but it's creating a shift in how we understand the world itself, where what counts as real is more and more something that we create for ourselves. And if you look at how we even measure things, so because everybody thinks, okay, measuring, there's, you know, you want evidence, big capital G, evidence, right? Okay, evidence, we'll go measure something, right? And that will tell us what is real. Well, think about what you follow when you measure things. Well, you need to do two things. First of all, you need to determine what you are measuring. Suppose I wanted to, well, I was trying to think of an example earlier. This situation isn't so good. But if you were measuring, say, students, right? Well, now right off the bat, you need to decide, well, what's going to count as a student, right? Do you count like real students, physical students? Do you count entire students or student segments or student parts? We have in the University environment the convenient fiction of FTEs, full-time equivalents, which is sort of like a virtual student. It's a non-real student, but that's what we count when we count students. And then we have scale. Students aren't so bad because you can count them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But if you're counting things like, I'll say, learning or intelligence or things like that, what are the scales that you're going to use? What is the scale for learning? What is one unit of learning? We grew up, one unit of learning was 1 hour, but 1 hour, or one class hour, or one FTE hour, these are all very different things. And so our measurement becomes a work of fiction. Our measurement becomes this world that we created, this reality that we created. And so the theme I want to touch on, the theme I want to have in the back of my mind as I give this talk are what are the realities, quote-unquote, that you find yourself in. Your institution, your students, your values, your finances, all of these are in a certain way constructs or fictions that we create that allow us to interpret the world. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That is the power, the capacity that these technologies have put into our hands. It's sort of, I come from Canada, I come from New Brunswick, Canada. Real nice place, it's all very natural and matured, lots of trees and forests, and I have deer outside my office. And I get on the plane, and I come out here, and I look around, and I think, and I say to myself, this should not exist. Southern California should not exist. It should be a desert. It's not real. And so, right off the bat, I'm thinking of none of this is real, but it is obviously real. It becomes what we created. That is a bad sentence. It becomes what we create. Now, we have this idea, this traditional conception of knowledge, this traditional conception of learning, of institutions, as these things that are real, capital R, and unchanging, permanent, things that we cannot influence, we cannot remake, and of course will persist forever. Even change is something that we see as inevitable. And you've probably all gotten a lot of that over time. Change theory being change agents, how change will always move us forward to bigger and better things. And those of you who are in technology probably know more than anyone else that change is not inevitable. It's not something that is always going to happen. And even when it does happen, it's not always going to be something that's good. The reality is that we define both online and offline what counts as real. Now, what counts as real is as much a question of attitude or perception. And this is something that varies from person to person, or even in the same person from time to time. This, as much as anything, is the environment we find ourselves in today. There is no single reality. There is no single institution. There is no single set of values. Think about what we think of as a student. What is a natural student? We always hear, the people coming out of high school or 17, 18 years old, that's our natural student base. What is a genuine student? Is that a person that's going to the university? There's a debate that happens a lot in the online, the open educational resources community is, who are these resources being defined for? And the natural presumption is that these resources are being created for people, for students, real students, who are in universities. But, of course, the internet changes that, doesn't it? And a person can be a student, even if they're not a student, properly so-called, enrolled in a university. Is a student a physical student? Is a student somebody who actually necessarily exists? What is learning? Same sort of question, same set of questions, right? What is natural learning? What is genuine learning? what is existent learning, and again, the question of how we measure it. These are, you know, my background is in philosophy, and so these are the sorts of questions that I always have in the back of my mind. And these are the sorts of questions that I think more and more we need to ask as we are presented with technology, as we are presented with theories in education. I'll give you an example of the sort of thing I mean. I was told, and I'm not, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it isn't, that there will be some students along with Mark Prensky tomorrow. That's a good thing, but I'm a philosopher, so the first thing I'm thinking is, okay, are they real students? And they'll be certainly in the right age group, but they probably won't be Mark's students, because, you know, I don't think he lives here. Does he live here?
No.
No, okay. So now we have these, they're sort of not real students, and yet they're students. Are they typical students, or were they hand-picked students? Now, those sorts of questions, now, I'm not saying anything against these, I have never met them, so I don't know, right? But these are the sorts of questions that you need to have in the back of your mind, because it's very easy to come to something like this, look at the presenter, look at the students, and say, I saw the student saying such and such, and therefore students say such and such. But they might not be real. Reality is something that becomes a fluid thing. The reality is that learning has changed. Learning has changed from being about reality. Learning has changed from being the presentation of the way the world is to rather questioning the way the world is, and indeed even creating worlds, creating the way the world is. This has always been a theme of mine, and what underlies a lot of the work that I've done in online learning, the idea that what this technology does, in addition to bringing learning into, you know, everybody's houses, it gives them capacities that they never had before. It gives them a much greater ability to shape their own identity, their own lives, their own world. People like Dana Boyd, for example, studying MySpace, see these online environments as places in which people create their own identity. I grew up in multi-user dungeons, MUDs. That was my online introduction. And I could see for myself people creating their own identities. Well, I did it myself. I created my own MUD identity, and my own MUD identity, my virtual, my non-real identity, became part of my real identity. The person that I made myself in this virtual world became the person that I am really. So, yes, I'm actually not real. The old model of learning, you've all seen the old model of learning. Some of you may have helped contribute to it. We will talk about that later. Is this old delivery model, right? This is the model of Moore, and this is the model of the information theorist, this is the model of the cognitive theorist, where we've got the shareable content objects. Again, being a Canadian, I can't help but notice the jet airplane being shareable anyhow. But the idea is, you have these things, you mash them in a machine, and you fire them into a person's brain, and the model here is, you know, it's insidious, because it's not simply that you're pushing facts into people's brains, but that is how you create reality for those people. You are making these things and pushing this thing, and that will become the person's reality, and it's totally delivered. It's completely it's received, and nothing but received. Oh, bad phrasing. It is simply received by the student. The student does not form an active part in its creation. Thinking about what we think is real. We think of learning as remembering. Right? Isn't that what testing is all about, right? What you're going to do if you're going to be tested is show what you remember. Did you get that date right? Can you calculate that equation? Can you name all of the states and all of their capitals and the capitals that were there? Yeah. But learning is not remembering. I think it's very clear that learning is not remembering. We can remember without learning. How many of you remember the phrase, 'twas brilliant, and I can't remember. How many of you remember it? How many of you know what it means? Right? You remember it, but there's no meaning. So there's a really important sense in which you didn't learn it. In fact, couldn't learn it because there's nothing there to learn except the empty sentence. I spent my time when I was growing up in places like 7-Eleven stores. I was a 7-Eleven clerk for a while, and I worked also at a football stadium in Ottawa. And one of the things I learned in those environments is you get the new people in, and even though they have studied math in school, you teach them how to do something called counting change. And counting change, you've probably seen it. You go to the store, you buy something, the person counts it up, right? You know, 50, 75, $1, $2, $5, 20, right? They count it out. And the reason for that is people can remember mathematics without understanding quantities. And so if they just run through the formulas that they learned and they make a $20 error, they're not able to perceive that they made a $20 error. They don't have the sense of quantities. So the counting change was introduced so that people don't make these quantity errors, that they have to end up at the size of the bill or whatever that the customer gave them. Another example, and it's not on the thing, but I play darts a lot. And people count differently. They add their scores differently when they play darts, when they're just new at darts, and when they're experienced at darts. When they're just new at darts, they do their math. 3 times 17, 5 times 17, they work it out, and then they subtract. Eventually, once they're experienced dart players, they don't need to go through those calculations. They understand what these quantities are, what these quantities mean. There's a distinction, a difference between remembering and learning. Learning is not content. Learning is not the sentence, the fact. Learning is, in fact, the way I would represent it, a process of becoming. A process of instantiating a particular set of neural connections. So when we learn, we don't acquire things. When we learn, rather, we change our state. We become, I don't know how else to say it, so I'll just say we change. And it's important because, you know, I'm sure you're all familiar with the phrase making meaning, but even that is misrepresentative, because when you learn, it's not that you make something, it's not that you build something or construct something, but rather what you are attempting to do is to grow a new configuration, a new set of neural connections in your mind. You are trying to grow from what you were into this learning, or this learning being. This is important because it shapes a lot of what we want to do. It shapes the way we want to structure learning online. Again, a lot of people think that learning is the presentation even of sentences. But so much of learning is not even syntactical. This is why we shouldn't think of learning even in cognitivist sense. We shouldn't think of learning as sets of propositions, for example. Learning can be tacit. It can be ineffable. It can be something that you can't put into words. The example that Michael Polanyi gives, learning how to ride a bicycle, is something that you could sit there and describe riding a bicycle all day long, and you would still not know how to ride a bicycle. A person, on the other hand, who knows how to ride a bicycle, may not actually be able to explain or describe in words what that learning is. And learning also is personal. It depends on context. It's not something that you can generalize. What you learn and what I learn, even if it's the same fact, are two different things. The example I always use for this, maybe overused, but I like it. Think of, say, Paris. Everybody think of Paris. Okay. How many of you thought of the capital of France? Okay. A few. Not very many. How many of you thought of Paris Hilton? A few. That's my nail. How many of you thought of Plaster of Paris? No? The thing is, if learning were something that were generalizable and I said Paris, everybody would think of all and exactly the same thing. But in fact, each of you has a unique set of concepts, a unique idea that you associate with Paris. What you learn, even if I present one single sentence to you, like Paris is the capital of France, what I've done is actually created, well, I don't know, 400, I guess, separate instances of that piece of learning. What knowing is, therefore, changes as well. The old way, the realist with the capital Arley, is that knowing is about rules, it's about categories, it's about knowing what taxonomies there are, what kinds of things that there are, what the laws of nature are. Learning on this new picture, though, is more like recognizing. It's more like seeing patterns or similarities. I sometimes say, people ask me, well, what is knowledge? I tell them, knowledge is like finding Waldo. You've all heard of Where's Waldo, right? Knowledge is like finding Waldo. You're searching around, finally you find Waldo. And once you've found Waldo, you can't unfind him again. He's always there. And it's like that. It's like recognizing, you see where Waldo is, and you snap into that state of awareness. There's all kinds of these, I like to run them in my newsletter, they're not really optical illusions, but they're these figures. You may have seen there's one with the woman that's dancing, and sometimes you perceive her, she's going one way, and another time you perceive her, she's going another way. Or there's the famous example of the duck rabbit, and you see a figure, I should have it on the screen, but I don't have it, where it looks kind of like this. Back on my video there. And then this trip there, get it kind of right. How's that for this? Is this real or never mind. It could be a duck or it could be a rabbit. And the thing is, you see it as either a duck or a rabbit, but once you see it, you sort of snap into recognizing it. Okay, that's pretty bad. But the main idea here is that learning is a process whereby what you see, what's presented in front of you, creates a characteristic recognition. It's similar to something that you've already seen. It looks like this. This is obviously a very stylized representation of a network, of a neural network. Our concept of, say, a tree is actually a set of connections between the different, well, the neurons or the different entities in the network. And so to recognize a tree is to stimulate those connections that have been stimulated on previous recognitions of trees. In other words, it's a pattern of connectivity. The concept of tree is for you a pattern of connectivity in your mind. And the thing is, these patterns all take place in the same neural network. So your thoughts or your experiences of a puppy dog can shape or influence your experiences of a tree, even though sententially, even though cognitively, they have nothing to do with each other, because they are represented in the same network, the one concept affects the other concept. There are different ways in which these patterns of connectivity are created in the mind, and here's three of them, and I've been toying around with the fourth one as well. Associationism, that's the idea that things that are similar create connections among themselves. So if If you have one perception of redness and another perception of redness, that creates a connection. Sorry, I'm seeing people laughing, and I'm not sure whether it's at you. Really? I'm not going to ask which, because I don't want to know. I looked and I go, see, I should have left it for more than 10 seconds. I didn't expect it, that would throw me off, but it did. I didn't want to ask that, but I needed to know that. All right, where was it? Association is. Never mind. Okay. The main point, and I don't want to go into too much detail here because I'm obviously not going to be able to do that. The main point I want to bring across is that learning is the process of forming connections between the neurons in your mind, and that there are basic ways in which these connections are formed. There's connections according to Hebbian associationism, which is the similarity of, you know, if two neurons fire at the same time and don't fire at the same time, there is a tendency for those two neurons to become connected. It's not on this list, but there's also proximity, two things that are nearer to each other or related to each other in a certain way. For example, the two neural cells that are beside each other on the retina will be related by virtue of that spatial relationship. Those are perceptual ways in which learning takes place. And then there are more cognitive ways or reflective ways in which learning takes place. One of them is backpropagation. That's a theory that originates from the connectionist school of computer science. And the idea is that you have a perception, it creates a set of connections in a neural net, and that produces an output. And then there's a reaction or feedback to that output fed back through the network, and that changes the set of connections between the neurons. So think of it as kind of like a feedback mechanism. And then finally, there's a Boltzmann mechanism for forming connections. And the way I like to describe that is, toss a rock into the water settles into what is the most, I don't want to say natural, but the most state of equilibrium. It gets flat, it's water. The same sort of thing happens with neural nets. Neurons are active, they send electrical signals back and forth, there's potentials and all of that, so there's a stable state in which these connections can settle. And the idea is that in Boltzmann connections, you shake up the network, and the network, all the connections go back and forth, and the signals go back and forth, and then it sort of settles into a state. And then you shake it again, and they all settle into a state. The main thing is, we know what creates these connections. We know what these mechanisms are. And these mechanisms tell us about how people learn things. And they tell us not simply about how people learn things, they tell us how networks in general learn things. And this is an important concept because it means that the mechanisms that a network, such as the one we see in society or the one we see online, the mechanisms that govern that kind of network are the same sort of things as the mechanisms that govern the networks that is in our mind that we learn with. And this is the picture of learning that emerges from those sorts of reflections. The picture of learning, first of all, through practice and reflection on the part of the student, and secondly, through that's the second you see it. And you get only the second part of the sentence there. Modeling or demonstration on the part of the teacher, and the idea is that you're presenting the experiences that the person will have, and the person through this process of practicing and reflecting on these experiences they learn. So, I guess I should have put a character limit on that. Creativity is the true reality. Sorry, I am really thrown off by that. I've done this before and I wasn't so thrown off by it, but now I'm just kind of... All right. Okay. Does anyone have the time, please?
Mine's 26.
Okay. So I want to be careful not to go over time. Where this leads us is what we might call, this might call e-learning 2.0. And I take both the credit and the blame for coming up with that term. And the idea of e-learning 2.0 is that learning is based not on objects and contents, it's not based on propositions and sentences, but rather that they're stored as though they're in a library, but rather learning is like experience. Learning is like utility. Learning is something that's ongoing. The resources that we use to learn, the experiences that we use to learn, are always present. They're ubiquitous. They're like water in the plumbing system. They're like electricity in the electrical system. And as I said before, the way we learn in the network is the way we learn as people. It's a complex system. And in both cases, the learning depends on the connections between, and in one case, the neurons, and in the other case, between the people. The idea of e-learning 2.0 is that learning is learner-centered. It's centered around the interests of the learner. It is owned by the learner. What that implies is that the person who is doing the learning has control over the subject, over the learning materials, over even the style of learning. Sorry, I'm getting thrown off track here, and I don't like that. So I'm just going to... Okay. There's where I want to go. What I want to do very briefly is sketch some of the major underlying technologies of e-learning 2.0 and Web 2.0 itself. The idea of the unorganized, the unplanned, the uncontrollable. The idea, and I think this is an important component because we have this idea that these things are managed ahead of time. And what we're seeing through the use of the e-learning 2.0 technologies like blogs and wikis and that is unorganized, unplanned learning. We're seeing messy learning. This talk is an example of messy learning in its own way. What? Never mind. I don't even know what they're trying to do with this. Thank you. It's the idea of learning as user-generated concept. Again, in traditional learning, the experts produce the content, they package the content, they peer review the content, they deliver the content, and the learner learns it. But learning in the network environment is rather a matter of individual learners creating their own content and learning through creating content, exchanging content, having conversations among themselves. And I know that's, I'm standing here and I'm just thinking, it sounds somewhat like buzzwords. And it is buzzwords, but it's also what's actually happening where, the experience that I have is with people who are creating their own blogs, or sometimes wikis, less common, their own blogs or on discussion boards or message boards or whatever, actually creating learning among themselves, not by trying to teach themselves or anything like that, but simply floating ideas, simply getting concepts out there, trying them out, seeing if they work, getting the feedback, getting the results. I see my own website as my own learning tool, my own place where I learn, where I put these concepts out, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. and I get the feedback. And the idea here is that, in theory, what should be happening is I keep the things that work and throw away the things that don't, although I don't always do that because sometimes I'm attached to the things that don't work. But it becomes this iterative process back and forth. A lot of the things that I present in talks like this, I present them to not so much to say, well, this is true, but I present them to say, okay, well, this is the way I think the world works, the way I think it unfolds. And then I hear back the way other people think it unfolds. And we work back and forth and back and forth. And the idea here is that as these thoughts, as these concepts go from person to person to person, what I represent as a network in a society, that learning happens in that society, and it's hard to explain because you sort of think, you get this common idea of society, or this common understanding, this sense of shared commitment or shared values. And I don't think that that's the way it works at all. I don't think that social learning is everybody coming to believe the same thing, everybody coming to have the same ideas, the same understanding of reality. But rather, I think that it's each person having their own ideas, their own values, their own beliefs, and then the learning that comes from society as being the result of all of those things. So I'm going to skip because I know I'm going to run out of time if I don't skip, and I want to talk about this. What I want to talk about, this is probably where I probably shouldn't have done the other slides in the middle, and live and learn. What I want to get at is why I would want to promote this idea of network learning at all. And there's a few things here. First of all, just simply the nature of the learner, people are less networks, but also it's my view, it's my belief that we actually get better knowledge, higher quality knowledge using networks than using what might be considered to be more traditional ways of creating learning, by measuring things, for example. How do I want to put this? When we measure things, when we do experiments or whatever, we get a certain kind of knowledge. We get knowledge of causes and effects. But there are many things that are not simply causes and effects. They're much more complex systems, like the weather, for example. The weather is not something that can be predicted simply through causes and effects. It's a complex system, which means that we need more, my brain says, say more aware systems, and my head's saying, no, don't say more aware systems, and not even a sentence. But if you think about it, think about two ways of organizing the society, or organizing learning, or organizing a school. A group versus a network. The idea here is that a group is a collection that is defined according to the properties of its members. A group is the sort of thing that where you value sameness. And you define a group by identifying the properties of that person, the properties of the members of that group, and then counting. Sorry, I'm just throwing off.
Cathedral versus the bazaar.
Yeah. Basically, the bazaar being the idea that everybody. I don't even want to say it that way. Okay, what? Alright, I'm going to do one more thing and then I'm going to wrap it up because. But come back Saturday, it would be much better. And to be very honest with you, I think that actually is throwing me off, because I think I'm thinking, well, gee, if they don't like it now, then I'll come back Saturday. Won't be anybody here. Anyhow. Actually, you guys are being really kind, and I appreciate that. Okay. Because of what we know about networks, and again, I've thought about this quite a bit, although it doesn't always show, we can identify ways in which networks can be effective and ways in which networks are not effective. A way in which a network is not effective is if it propagates something to the extreme. For example, in a network, like in a society, a badly functioning network will... Oh, man. You know, now I know how Miss North Carolina feels. This is something like my 167th presentation, and they haven't all been bad. Four major things that a network should have: diversity, autonomy, openness, and interaction. Now, what I mean when I say that is that, there goes Peter. What I mean when I say that is, when we design technologies that are intended to work in a network, we need to design technologies that embody these. And when we are considering acquiring or purchasing technologies, we need to be looking at the technology to see if they support these things. One of the things that I was listening outside before the talk, and they were saying, you know, what are the big issues? Well, one of the big issues at this conference is Second Life. And so we asked, okay, is Second Life an appropriate tool to use in a network learning environment? And the way to answer that sort of question is to ask, well, does Second Life support diversity? Does Second Life support autonomy? Does it support openness? Does it support interaction? There are some things Second Life does really well. Second Life, for example, supports... Second Life supports interaction really well. And it reminds me of the MUDs that I used to grow up on. And people log on and they communicate with each other and they really connect. And you know, it's funny, I mean, because the people who support Second Life are almost fanatical in their support of Second Life. And it's because of this interaction that they are so supportive of Second Life. But does Second Life support diversity? Well, that I'm not sure about. If you want to use Second Life, you have to go to Second Life. It used to be you had to use the Second Life client, but now they've open sourced the client, so you don't have to use the Second Life client. But still, you're in their world. It's kind of like going to Disneyland, right? You're in the Disney world. You don't go to Disneyland and be an anarchist or anything like that. Okay, bad example. Does Second Life promote autonomy? Does it allow people to make their own decisions? You know, I signed on to Second Life and they said, well, you have to pick a last name. I ended up with the last name Pawpaw. I don't want to be Pawpaw. You know, I don't want to be any of their last names. I want to be my last name. And so there's a sense in which, you know, you're rooted or streamed by the technology. Again, it felt like Disney. I was walking around Disney. Everywhere you walk in Disneyland, it feels like they're directing you somewhere. It was so strange. Just walking along the sidewalk has this big curve around, and then that's where they want you to be. And Second Life feels that way a little bit. Second Life is the experience of 3D, but the experience of 3D the way they want it to be for you. We're going to see in the world of 3D internet, we're going to see technology that goes beyond Second Life, that allows people to create their own worlds without having to rely on Second Life, that allows people to be in control of their own avatars, their own identities. It's going to be a type of Second Life, except it will be open. It'll allow people to plug in other things. It'll allow people to create their own things and interact and connect them together. The same thing in the other big technology that people are using these days is Facebook. And again, ask ourselves the same sort of questions of Facebook, right? Does it support diversity? Does it support autonomy? Everybody's been making a big deal about the way Facebook can act as a platform for all of these other applications. And yeah, sure, it can act as a platform for these applications, but do these applications support the semantic principle? Do they support diversity and autonomy and openness and interaction? In some cases, they do a little bit, but in a lot of the cases, they're not actually promoting diversity. They're not promoting autonomy. You know, if anything, again, you go to Facebook, you sort of feel like you're being herded. You feel like, you know, you get the message, sign up for this, sign up for that. And so the autonomy isn't there that you would like. And it's in the other slides. There's been work being done by people like David McCordon and Brad Fitzpatrick and others to create what they call the open social graph. I really don't like that terminology. But what they mean is a social network that isn't based on one application or one website like Facebook, but rather an application, but rather a social network that is not dependent on any individual application at all, where you can choose from any number of applications, where the identity that you have is consistent across these sites. You can go to Google, you can go to Yahoo, you go to LiveJournal, you go to Blogger, wherever, and you're the same person. And that person is who you choose to be. And then the network of friends, if you will, I don't like that term necessarily either, but the network of connections of people that you know in the community is something that you can bring with you or not as you choose. And consequently, I think, will be that that environment is what will become the learning environment. That's what I know I'm really struggling to get this out, so I appreciate the patience. But I really think that the picture that we have now of learning applications, such as learning management systems, which are institutional-based, which are based on site-based logons and contents that are local content, I think that is going to be replaced by this distributed set of applications, so that having an online learning presence will not be so much having a website, an application, and a database where you're setting all these things up for your students, but rather setting up a set of applications or servers that are intended not to distribute or not to serve web pages to people, but rather to connect to other applications. So if you want to think of the content that you're creating and think of the services that you're creating as things that will be reaching through other applications to people, and you don't necessarily know what those applications are going to be, and you don't know necessarily what context these things are going to be viewed in. A way of thinking of it, and this is only a way of thinking, but imagine somebody in Second Life or in Facebook or whatever, doing whatever it is they're doing, trudging along, conversing with their friends, they encounter some of the content that you've provided. And presumably you provided this content in order to advance some sort of learning objective. But the thing is, they encounter it. And what happens is, they pick it up. And I'm obviously speaking metaphorically because it's a digital world. But they pick it up, they start doing things with it, they rework it, they embed it in their messages that they send to each other, they create something new with it. The learning that happens as a result of this happens not because of the content of that content that you sent out, not because of the content of that learning material, but rather because of the things that they do with that learning material. That is where the learning actually happens. And so, when you're creating these learning materials, what you want to be doing is focusing not so much on what the learning material says, but rather on how the learning material is going to be used. What sort of things, what sort of capacities this learning material is going to give the person who acquires it. Now, and I'll just wrap up on this note. I do things like record my talks and stuff like that. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So, you know, there's actually evidence of this talk that will be in existence for the rest of my life. And the reason why I do it is not because I think the content is so brilliant. But to be frank, sometimes the content is pretty bad. Other days it's pretty good. I mean, I don't always have bad days. But the reason why I do it, the reason why I've got the video going, the audio going, is because I'm going to take that, I'll put that on my website, and people can see, oh yeah, this is something that people can do. Right? It's the example that counts here. It's the idea of just on the fly creating a learning resource that's now out there. Anybody can use it. Anybody can share it. They take the video, they draw pictures of mustaches on it, doesn't matter. And the idea here is that I am showing what can be done in the hope that other people come along after and do the same thing, do it better, do it with things that I haven't thought about. And so that's the purpose of this sort of content. It's not to get the message across, it's to get the example out there and they can then do the same sort of thing. Only better. Please do it better. Thank you. Dollars for that. Thanks a lot. I do hope I'll be seeing all of you through the course of this conference. I will be preparing for the talk on Saturday. And the way I'll be preparing for the talk on Saturday is I'll be recording, not with this, but with actually my camera, your comments, your reactions, your talks. I might be showing up in your talk and recording a little bit of it. And all of those little bits and pieces are all going to come together to create my talk, whatever it happens to be on Saturday. I'm assuming I'll be in a totally different state, so it'll be more chaotic, but it'll be more organized, if that makes sense. I will be using that again. I might put it where I can see it. No, maybe not, eh? So do bring your computers, and this setup, well, that's good. That's nice to see. This setup will also be available should, say, people like Mark Penske or whoever are willing to actually engage, whatever the risk may be, with the audience. Maybe I shouldn't say that. I guess not. So anyhow, thank you very much, and I do look forward to being able to talk with all of you through the next few days, and certainly look forward to Saturday. So thanks again.
Thank you. Okay, see it. There we go.